You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Good morning, gardeners. I'm Virginia Haywood, and with you are Merrill Johnson from Seedscape and Stephen Ryan from Dixonia Rare Plants.
And
they
morning.
Are actually with you now.
We were having a lovely chat amongst ourselves
apparently, but we weren't aware, so we thought everybody else was listening as well. But
we'll take two on that.
Yes.
We were congratulating ourselves on the size of our frosts.
Well, there's always something you can be happy about, I suppose. Yes.
You would get a lot of frosts in Gippsland.
We do get a lot of frosts, and it's the lie of the land too, which is so important for the microclimates of gardens. We've got a relatively flat garden, which in West Gippsland, in the foothills of the Baw Ranges, is an unlikely scenario to have some flat land. But what happens is we've got high ground above us, frost rolls down, stops at the flat ground and settles.
And settles, yes, exactly. That's always the problem.
If there's a bit of a breeze, it keeps going down the next hill, but if it's still,
I'm completely saved from frost. Even when it's quite bad, for me, it rolls off the hill.
Yes, you've got the right lie of the land.
The right lie. The first thing that goes is the heliotrope.
Yes, I can well imagine it would, in fact.
Yes.
But it's the same where
black,
I am.
Black.
Frost in our own garden, although we've got quite a big tree cover over part of it, so that doesn't get terribly frosty. But up at the nursery, because it's up on the hill, we don't get much frost. So
no,
I can grow things
going
up there that I know I can't grow down in the garden at home.
On the flatter land.
On the flatter land, and it's only 5 minutes by car.
Yeah.
You know, so it's quite close by.
Well, I mean, all my neighbours will get frost.
Yeah.
And mine will roll down the hill.
Yeah. I was actually quite pleased to see it because I was getting quite worried about how mild the autumn, early winter had been. And it was unnaturally mild.
And you do
need
those,
the frost.
Yeah, you need the frost. I mean, it knocks a lot of bugs and pests and things about a bit. So it gives the garden a bit of a rest from some of those predatory things. So,
and it gives the plants a rest that they do go into proper dormancy and build up this. They're still eating. Their roots are still working. Things are happening just on a slower motion.
Well, I've got whitefly.
Yes.
Which I don't want.
And they should be gone. So come on, frost.
My winter sweet is almost in full leaf.
Which is
weird.
Yes.
I mean, it's in full flower. And the perfume's fabulous, but you can hardly see the flowers because it's all leafy. I mean, some of the leaves have gone yellow and dropped, but really I'd say a good two-thirds of the foliage is still green.
Yeah.
So it hasn't thought it was winter yet.
No.
Well, I was quite shocked by how much, because I've been away, of course, for 7 weeks, and I've come back and I've got flowers all over my garden.
Yes, it's been too mild for them to finish and go to sleep. Time to go to sleep, plants.
And I noticed on the quince, a really big bug, shoot. It's trying to flower.
Yes.
And that will not survive if it comes, and it's a really nice bud.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, well, anyhow, it is what it is. And as gardeners, we just have to cope with whatever nature throws at us.
We just take it in our stride.
Yep, and hopefully so do our plants.
Exactly.
Well, one of the things that I did while I was away is I went on tour with Stephen.
Mm. Yes, you did indeed.
Which was truly wonderful. And we went to the Madeira and the Azores.
Which is a fabulous part of the world.
It really is.
It's really great. I mean, you've got all that Portuguese history. So you've got the food and the architecture and the man-made landscape. And then you're on these amazing volcanic islands with crater lakes and steep mountainsides covered in greenery. And
so many waterfalls. I've never seen so many waterfalls.
Yes. You can stand in one spot on the island of Flores and see about 10 waterfalls all the way around the cliff faces. It's just remarkable.
This is a rival for my collection of photographs of waterfalls in Norway.
Oh, yes, that would be another place that would do that well. But, so we had a lovely time. We had a few issues with cancelled or suspended flights and things and what have you. But, I mean, touring can do that to you.
Well, especially in these current times.
Yes.
Well, I think the problem too is that the Azores are pretty wild.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing it's, what, 2 hours to Lisbon in one direction and 4.5 hours to New York in the other direction.
Yep.
And you're just there in the middle of the Atlantic.
Yeah. So the weather can be
unpredictable. And the planes are small and the runways are small.
Small, yes. So, yes. So there's all those things conspiring against you unless the weather's just perfect. But we did see some gorgeous things. I mean, that hotel we stay in...
with the garden.
With the botanic garden around it.
It has got the most extraordinary garden.
It is.
It was beautiful.
Absolutely fabulous. So, you know, some of those highlights of the tour are things we'll always take with us, I guess.
Yes.
And for me, I think one of the highlights is going to the island of Flores because it's the most sort of westerly of the whole group and it's smallish. There's really only one place to stay on the whole island, which was cute.
It was very cute. It's an old village and this village had been abandoned by the whole bang lot in the 60s, probably because JFK did a deal with the Azorians that if there was a disaster, they could move to America.
Yes.
I suspect that's the reason, because they all went, the whole 205 or
they
whatever.
Accepted the invitation.
And in the 90s, somebody bought a couple of the houses, and they're, you know, real old village houses all made out of stone.
Yes.
Gorgeous little buildings.
Absolutely gorgeous, and liked it, so decided to turn the thing into a hotel. And if you look at it, you wouldn't know it was a hotel.
Yeah, it's a concept that's becoming really popular in Italy too.
Mm. How wonderful.
Taking up the old villages that have, old agricultural villages that have largely, if not wholly, been abandoned, restoring them and, again, putting beautiful gardens around them. And it's just a lovely way to stay in the countryside and open the window and listen to the nightingales calling.
I heard a program on the radio when I was in London about how Italy's forests are moving forward.
Thank goodness.
Because so much of the farming has been abandoned and they're having problems because city people are thinking they should be able to go and walk in the forests and are not pleased that they come across wolves and various things that are threatening to their dogs, etc. And they want to start getting rid of them, and there's been a big debate. Yes, well, quite. I assume they won't win.
Well, let's hope
not. Because it's a stupid argument.
We won't start on the recent defunctioning of preservation laws in America.
Yeah.
No, that's right.
We won't even go there.
But
I was almost going to, but no, you're right, we shouldn't.
We should concentrate on enjoying our plants and gardens.
Yes, exactly.
Well, this particular garden around this hotel, it had the most glorious trees.
Mm.
Yes.
Amazing trees. And the only place in Europe, and I'm putting exclamation marks in the air that our viewers or our listeners can't see, because it is out in the middle of the Atlantic, but it's part of Portugal, so it's considered part of Europe. Only place in Europe you can grow giant Amazonian water lilies outdoors.
Oh, wow.
And they have, I mean, they weren't up when we were there because it was too early in the season, but they have these ponds in this garden, and it's on an island that has quite a lot of thermal action going on. So some of the ponds are warm.
Warm, yes.
And so they can grow Amazonian water lilies out in the garden. And they've also got a tea industry there. They've got tea plantations.
Wow. And we went to the only coffee farm in Europe.
And a coffee farm there as well. It is just so different.
Our island climates are just extraordinary, aren't they? And they're
exciting.
Grow plants that...
Well, I couldn't believe the size of the trees.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
Because they're getting regular rainfall.
Well, is it or is it more than that? I mean, the Metrosideros, you know, the New Zealand Christmas tree.
Yeah, they had trunks on them wider than this studio. They're bigger than I've ever seen in New Zealand.
Yes,
absolutely. They were huge. I just kept going around saying, oh, there's another one.
Yeah, and huge Araucarias.
That was the other one. There were so many. The Araucarias are the southern hemisphere pine tree.
Yeah.
And there were so many of them.
Norfolk Islands, Bunyas.
Bunyas. We saw quite a lot of Bunyas.
And that's another interesting thing about the plant colonies on islands stuck in the middle of an ocean, because everybody passing through always stopped for water or food or rest or repairs or whatever they needed to stop for. But they always brought stuff with them. So they're kind of like little hothouses of the world's flora.
Well, it's obviously still going on, because this garden at this hotel, this botanic garden at this hotel, also had three very nice Woolamai pines.
Oh, I'm glad. So, I'm really glad.
Yeah, in amongst their cycad collection, which was amazing.
Yeah, the cycad collection was extraordinary.
Yeah, so, you know, there's all sorts of unexpected stuff that goes on when you go on these trips. And of course, for me, it's the endemics.
Yes.
You know, the local endemic species. I mean, the Azores and Madeira have some wonderful plants that grow nowhere else naturally in the world. So
as well as all the introductions, thank goodness they're managing to keep some of their
endemics. Well, they're struggling to.
Yes.
Ginger lily is taking over some of the Azorean islands, and Pittosporum undulatum.
Oh my goodness.
Has taken off.
Seeding with a will.
Yeah. Well, they were bought in to put around citrus orchards as windbreaks. And they've just taken over some of the forests in the Azores. So there's any number of exotic weedy species that are a problem, and they just don't have the manpower and the money to deal with it particularly well. So they're just sitting there watching it happen around them, unfortunately. So it's worth going to see it before some of it's gone, sadly.
Yes. But what's happening in your garden or nursery at the moment, Stephen, now that we've decided that the frosts will finally make things go to sleep? Are there any treasures popping up?
Yeah, look, there's all sorts of stuff happening at the moment. I mean, midwinter sounds like the lowest point of the year, but certainly with things like bulbous plants, for instance, I mean, all my snowdrops are out in flower at the moment.
Likewise, little snowies are just carpeting. And the little varmints are seeding themselves. So I'm getting new colonies in places I didn't previously have them. I'm loving it.
Yes. It's sad when they go feral, isn't it? And the other one that's really a cheer for me at this time of the year are the little winter aconites, the aranthuses. They're all popping up with their little yellow flowers with their Elizabethan ruffs of leaves, which I find highly appealing. I think it's one of those gorgeous little
plants. Especially the dark-leafed one.
Yeah, and the cyclamen cooma in full bloom.
I was about to mention my cyclamen patch, because it's a joy to me at the moment. And the winter perfumes. I love plants that are perfumed in the winter. They're always strongly perfumed because they're trying to haul in the pollinators from a
anything
long way
that's out
away.
There.
and so they tend to have beautiful perfumes that waft on the air, and that's one of the great treats of winter gardening.
Yep.
In fact, I love my winter garden. I had a friend come and visit the other day, and she said, "Oh, the garden's quite bare, isn't it?" Well, it's just that you weren't looking hard enough, lovey, because...
But also, I love the structure.
Yeah. I do too.
It is nice to see what the garden's looking like. I said that to Stephen Wells last night. You must come and have a look, because the structure is clear in my garden at the moment.
And I love the silhouette of bare trees. I don't know why people get thingy about deciduous trees. I think trees that drop their leaves in the winter, they punctuate your season, so your garden really looks like the season it is, which I think is very useful.
Yes.
And especially if you're in the country and you get those lovely mists that close in around, and when they waft through the bare trees, I mean, it's just so romantic. You wonder where Heathcliff is.
And you need to look at bark. You need to look at trunks, and people forget to do that
You do in the winter.
Yeah.
But it's nice to take a walk when everything's in full abundance in, you know, spring and through the summer and even into autumn. You're sort of dazzled by all the colour, and you tend to just stand and look, but you go for a walk in winter because you're determined to get to the, you know, the first daffodils or the jonquils that are scenting the air. at the moment, or the little cyclamens. I've got some really dark purple ones that are still blooming. They're really meant to be autumn bloomers, but they're carrying on because of the mild season.
I had my first spring one out the other day.
I know.
Yeah, so cyclamen repandum that's supposed to be out as my main spring one. The first flower or two was up the other day, and I thought, that's a tiny bit early. It's pretty easy.
Slow down.
But my Canarina canariensis, I've put it on our page so people can have a look at the flower.
Mm.
It is so beautiful. And I've got four of them, and three of them are in flower.
Yeah.
And they just...
I struggle with that up at Macedon because of the frost.
Do you?
Yeah. So I can often get a Canarina in flower. And for people who don't know it, it's a climbing campanula relative that comes from the Canary Islands. So same group of islands that Madeira and the Azores belong to, the Macaronesian Islands. And it's the most beautiful thing, and it's summer dormant. So it comes up in the winter, does its thing, and then disappears in the summer, so you can completely ignore it. You don't have to water, or in fact, it's better not to. You just let it sit there, and it will just scramble over the top of other shrubs or run up a fence through another climber. And these big...
Because it's a gentle climber,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, and because it's herbaceous too, it can't swamp anything.
Yes.
I quite like herbaceous climbers. Mm. People look at you weird when you say you're planting a herbaceous climber, because most people plant climbers to hide something. So they want to hide the fence, cover the pergola, hide the ugly shed, whatever. So they want something permanent. So they don't actually understand the value of herbaceous climbers, because they can be run up through other plants and they do no harm. Mm. They come up, do their thing, disappear again.
Yep.
There should be more of them. Mm. I adore them.
I was going to say a controversial thing this morning, because I actually love summer dormant plants, summer dormant perennials.
Yep.
Yes.
Because they do their stuff in the late winter and through the spring, and especially ones that, you know, do their stuff in the late winter. I just adore them, because it's sort of the herald of spring. It cheers you up, the cold
and
weather.
And look, it makes, particularly if you're growing a lot of perennials in your garden, it makes your beds look at least a little bit furnished earlier in the season as well.
Exactly,
so
exactly.
Very useful.
But ones that go dormant in the summer allow you room to grow those spectacular annuals that are so easy to grow.
Mm.
Many you can just scatter the seed directly in the garden, or let them do it themselves year after year.
And my Cerinthia does that perfectly well.
I think Cerinthia is a wonderful plant.
It's a gorgeous little plant. It's all about, I suppose, 6 or 7 inches tall at the moment through my main border. And it's fabulous. It just comes back every year.
I love the colour structure of it, because it has those glaucous leaves, sort of waxy leaves that are really blue-green. And then you can have different varieties. The traditional one is sort of a really deep purple with blue tinges.
Yeah.
But you can get one called Kiwi Blue, which is much bluer. It has bluer foliage and bluer flowers. And I just love that colour. Mm. And it's immune to the winter frosts, actually.
Yeah.
Ours are up and blooming.
Well, it grows
and,
in Britain.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
that is Cerinthe, Cerinthe, if you want to look it up.
Yes. Fabulous plant.
Yeah.
And most of the time you don't see it, well, you won't see it for sale as a plant. You might get seed. Do you stock
we
the seed?
Yeah, for the purpura, the purple form, and the kiwi blue.
Yeah, so
the kiwi blue sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think I might have to get some of that as well.
It's a strain of purpurescence, but it's very pretty.
I don't think you can have too much anyway.
And it's so easy to deal with. I mean, if it comes up where it's a nuisance.
You just haul it out.
Comes up in my paths regularly and you think, well, you're never going to do anything there because you're going to get stood on at some point or another. So I pull them out of the paths, but I just let them come up. And because they've got that structure where there's nothing at the base really, so they don't take up room sideways at ground level, so they don't impinge on other plants particularly.
No, and they come up through things very well, because as you say, they're very upright and usually single stemmed. And so they come up, but then they nod over so gracefully. So they're rather nice coming up through carpeting plants. And
love it.
And just let them do their thing.
You are listening to the 3CR Garden Show. I'm Virginia Hayward, and with me today are Merrill Johnson and Stephen Ryan. If you want to give us a ring, you can give us a ring on 9419 0155, or you can send us a text on 0488 809 855. No photos on the text, because it won't come through to the computer. If you need to send us a question with a photo, go to 3cr.com. www.gardening@gmail.com.
There you go. So we'd love to hear from people.
We would.
But talking about summer dormant plants, there's far more out there than people realise. And another one, which I didn't bring any of but now thought I should have done, was ferula.
Yes,
the giant fennel.
Yes.
I just adore that plant. I mean, it's seed.
It's fabulous.
It's the most gorgeous thing. I mean, there's several species and they're all sort of somewhat similar. But this great fluff of foliage that's up in full flight at the moment, it'll flower in the spring with these sort of 8 or 10 foot tall spikes of yellow fennel-like flowers on them. And then it just quietly disappears for the summer and other things come into its space.
That's your space to have your sort of abundant summer flowering annuals, or be planting ready for autumn with echinaceas and heleniums and all of the beautiful cone flowers.
It's a great plant.
Yeah.
So, and of course, I love plants that have a history, and ferula is quite well known both in actual history and also in mythology. In actual history, the flower stems were dry, and inside the flower stems, it's all pithy.
Yes.
And if you have visions of naked athletes running up the side of Mount Olympus, which you may well have, what they would have been running up the side of Mount Olympus was something that looked like a giant smouldering cigarette, which was the stem of a ferula. That's how they moved the fire around. It was used to discipline naughty schoolboys. Given a whack on the backside. There was a ferula species that in its time, and it's thought to have possibly gone extinct, so nobody's quite sure what it actually was, but it was so commonly used in ancient times that nobody really wrote down what you used it for, but it was worth its weight in gold. And it eventually, apparently, has become extinct. They've never found anything that they think might be this ferula that was really important back in ancient times.
So where does it come from?
They're Mediterranean in origin, although there is one ferula species, or it might be a subspecies that grows in the Canaries, ferula linkii. But ferula communis, I've seen it growing on Crete and all around the Mediterranean area.
It's great for really hot, dry, rocky, nasty places because that's where it just loves to be.
Yeah. Well, and the goats won't eat it.
No.
So, I've got it underneath my gum trees, where it still gets the northern light, so it's still getting a lot of sun.
Good.
Yeah. But it's a hard spot because it's so dry.
It's so tough.
Yeah, it is. It's really fabulous. And that's the thing I like about those sort of plants, because when they die down, you don't have to look after them. So there's something you don't have to water, so therefore you're saving water. There's normally plenty of other things to keep you entertained at that time of the year. But these things come up and do their thing in the winter and then just disappear.
And do both of you sell ferula?
I do sell the seeds.
Yeah, and I regularly have plants for sale, although I don't think I've got any at the moment. I'm waiting for the next crop of seed to come along. But I normally grow communis, linkii, and tingutana are the three ferulas I normally have, and they're all worth growing, albeit similar.
But I love them for their foliage. It's so fine
and foamy. The foliage is beautiful, isn't it? And it's better than fennel.
Yeah. Oh, much better than fennel. Mm.
We must mention, though, that you don't use it like fennel.
No.
It's not a herb that use in your cooking.
No.
So, and it doesn't smell aniseedy. There's no sort of real smell to it if you pick the foliage.
It's just architectural.
Oh, absolutely fabulous plant. And I actually bought a... Can we move on to some of the things I bought along?
Please do.
All right. Well, I was going to say, this was a topic that has sort of come about, was talking about summer dormant things. And so Virginia suggested I bring a few samples along of things that I grow that are summer dormant. And I have already put images out with our social media people, so I'm not quite sure where Daniel puts them up, but there will be pictures of the three plants I brought along today up there so that you can go and have a look at them, so that you can understand them if my descriptions don't help too much. But they're sort of plants that interest me in lots of different ways. And the first one I brought along is actually an arum.
And what a handsome chap he is.
It has a straight green leaf, so none of the marbling and things that some of the other arums have. It's nowhere near as vigorous and weedy as Arum italicum, which
is a creep.
It's a pain. I've got it in my garden at home and I love it during the winter months. It's growing in some areas where I can grow almost nothing else. but it is spreading around and it's becoming a bit of a nightmare. If it stayed put, I would be really pleased with it, but it's really hard to dig out, and it has sort of green flowers on it. But this one is one of the Mediterranean species that was only actually identified and given a name in the 1980s, I think, and it's Arum purpureo spathum. And it has the most fabulous lurid, dark, livery, burgundy, almost black flower with a classical arum lily-shaped flower.
But big. It's impressive.
It is an impressive flower, and the flower sits well clear of the foliage, yes. So it's not hidden by the foliage like some of the arums are. And I've noticed mine is gently self-seeding itself around a bit, but it's been in the garden for 15 or 20 years now.
And it hasn't gone
very far. And it hasn't taken off.
Yep.
I have got into the habit of decapitating the flower heads off a lot of my arums before they go to seed.
Oh, yes.
Just to be on the safe side. And this one doesn't really have any smell.
That,
yeah, because a lot of them stink.
Some of them can be. Well, that's their trick, isn't it? Yeah. That's how they get their pollinators. Yeah. They pretend to be dead meat.
Yes, exactly. And a friend of mine, actually, you'd know Greg Balderston quite well, most of you.
Absolutely.
Greg has a hybrid that showed up in his garden that's a cross between Purpureo spathum and Italicum. And it has the purpley flowers of Purpureo spathum, but marbled leaves like Italicum.
Ooh.
And he's calling it Signet, which was apparently the very first black hole named. So I quite like the name. And he's given me a couple of tubers of that, which I'm going to put in the garden somewhere. So
a treasure.
So some of the arums can be weedy, but some of them can be very, very good garden plants. And most of them are mid to late winter flowering. And then they just disappear in the summer.
Yeah. Which is exactly what we want. Now, yep. We have a message. Lovely to hear the conversation, although difficult when England are beating France so resoundingly.
Oh, dear. We've got some serious competition, it sounds like.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, oh, gosh.
Could you please repeat plant names? And I apologise for my lack of attention.
Well.
Thanks, Rosie.
Well, we've talked about Cerinthe.
Which I spelt out.
Yeah, so Cerinthe. We talked about Ferula, which is Ferula. And I've mentioned now Arum purpureo spathum, so Arum's easy, A-R-U-M.
And I talked about my favourite plant of the Mow, which is the Canarina canariensis.
Ah, yes. Yes.
And that's spelt as it sounds.
Yes, it's a Canary Island plant that comes from the Canary Islands and its name is Horticultural Tautology because it's Canarina, meaning it comes from the Canary Islands. Canariensis, meaning it comes from the Canary Islands.
Well, I just wanted to be sure.
Yes, that's right. So, yes, it was a waste of an opportunity, I felt. But anyhow, that is what it is.
And it is a wonderful plant.
Yes,
it is
definitely worthwhile looking out for.
But we'll try and take you on board there, Rosie, and repeat names as we talk.
And spell them out as well. As describing what we're talking about, because it has to be said, we get so enthusiastic and having so much fun, we forget that you can't see us.
Yeah, that's right. I'm even gesturing, so I don't know what use that is.
And I measure things, holding up my hands, you know. Sorry,
all
guys.
Those things that don't work on a vocal, not visual medium. But anyhow.
So the two people who are trying to talk to you visually are Meryl Johnson from Seedscape and Stephen Ryan from Dicksonia Rare Plants. And I'm Virginia Hayward. This is the 3CR Gardening Program. An old program, old and proud.
Yes,
exactly. Indeed.
Yes.
And we have a message from Fernie Creek, Fernie Creek Horticultural Society and the Alpine Garden Society Victoria are having a joint meeting on July the 25th. Summer flowering South American bulbs, and Jane Tonkin will be talking to this.
Fantastic.
It's 2 p.m. at the hall, 100 Hilton Road, and Jane will actually have plants for sales as well. So that on July the 25th will be definitely
good fun,
worth going to.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
Yes, Jane's a very engaging speaker.
She's a great speaker.
And definitely very knowledgeable. So.
And she has wonderful bowls.
Oh,
she does. She's got a fabulous collection. Actually, a generational collection, because her dad was such a great collector and then she took over the mantle and has added to the collection again. Mm. So it's a treasure in Australia.
It is, yes. But yes, and we need these treasures.
We do.
We're losing them bit by bit, sadly.
Rosie sent back, thank you very much. I didn't say the score at half time was 4-love.
Whoa!
That is extraordinary.
It won't be worth living in Britain.
I think we should just turn this off and yeah, go and just, turn yeah, on the telly.
Can we just put a connection through to the soccer and just let's go with that? Oh, dear.
May I throw in my summer dormant plant?
Please.
Because I have a lot of shade in my garden. We've got very big trees. I'm proud to say we planted most of them and they've managed to make great time and great girth and stature over the years. So, you know, don't give up. It's not too late to plant a tree. It's definitely not. But when they get very big, you do get a lot of quite dense shade. And this is, again, where some of the summer dormant plants can really come in. So the one I wanted to feature today was Mertensia virginica, or the Virginian bluebell. And this is one for you, Virginia. It's not only named for you, but it would be perfect in your garden. It's not a bluebell. Don't think it's a bulb.
There's lots of things called bluebells, isn't
there? Yes, but it does have flowers like an English bluebell in that they come up on a stem in a head, a scape, which nods over. So they're very graceful. And they open a sort of pinky purpley colour. And then as the flowers mature, they go azure blue. So that is stunning in the garden in late winter and early spring. And then it dies away for the summer. And
which means it's not going to die even if we have one of our hideous hot summers.
And you don't have to be watering under the trees where all your water just gets sucked up. So yeah,
disappears so fast.
So that is
a Mertensia virginica or Virginia bluebell. It's a very early bloomer and it is about 60 centimetres, about 2 feet high in flower. Rather lovely foliage, not dainty foliage. It's almost a comfrey style leaf, but it stays as a rosette down on the ground with the flower heads coming up above. Blooms its head off through late winter and into spring, and when things start getting hot and bothered, it just retires away for the summer, leaves me room for something else under there, or just some mulch to cover it up.
I would have assumed that it would be a really good companion plant for anything in the spring, or late winter, spring that's yellow. Because blue is such a valuable colour and looks so good with yellow. So if you had aconites or small daffodils or any of those sorts of things, yellow erythroniums, all that sort of stuff, it would look fabulous with that.
And it looks great with white too. Blue and white, I think, in the late winter sort of has that wintry frosty
wooden
feel.
Wooden anemones, maybe.
Yes, would which are, again, about to happen, I believe, just the way the weather's going.
Yeah.
And they form such a mat of well, what would you call them? Sort of rhizomes.
Yeah, little rhizomes, I guess, yes.
Yeah, and just a really surface rooting, but that doesn't seem to deter them from surviving quite hot, dry summers in the deep shade underneath trees and shrubs. So
and I've got a lupin that's about to flower. It's a really vivid blue. Well, it's not. It flowers at the end of winter. We're nearly at the end of winter.
Well, the way it's feeling, yes. Yeah.
And it's fabulous because it's a very nice leaf, much grayer than the Russell lupin that we see all the time. I can't grow Russells.
They don't like your soil.
No, I don't know whether it's the soil or I'm just a bit too hot and dry.
You're possibly too dry, I would have thought, in the summer, because although they go off a bit in the summer, they're not completely
They don't disappear.
Dormant.
Whereas this is actually an annual, but it seeds really well around itself. And
with the great big seeds, like pumpkin
seeds.
Yeah,
big seeds, yes. And it's
I hate to say it, the birds love them, so protect them from the parrots.
Mm. I haven't had that problem.
Touch wood.
Touch wood.
Oh, dear.
But the thing about it is the same. It flowers in late winter when you really need something.
Mm.
And I think it comes from Texas, Mexico, that sort
Could
of
be.
Area.
There's an awful lot of different lupin species that come from North America.
Mm. And from those plains. Mm. That's the beautiful thing about the Mertensia too. It doesn't mind humidity. Coming from Virginia, it's used to having sort of hot, clammy summers, and that doesn't deter it or
which we're tending to get a little bit of.
Yeah, we are.
Indeed. I can't tell you how vile the heat in London was.
Oh, yes, you were there right through that major heat wave, weren't you? Oh, dear.
Well, luckily I spent a bit of it in Ireland, so that was fine.
Mm.
But the bit in London, 2 days, couldn't leave the house.
Mm.
It's the humidity that gets you. It's not that it's any hotter than we experience, but we tend to get a drier heat.
The heat is much worse, and I think it's because nothing is built for heat.
Exactly.
I came out through Zurich Airport. That was where I picked up my long flight because of the man with the orange face having started another war.
Yes.
And Zurich Airport, which, of course, as you'd imagine, being Swiss, it's quite smart and, you know, nice, was unbearable. They don't have aircon.
No,
because they've never needed it.
No, never needed it.
Tell you what, they need it now.
Oh, dear.
Oh, we've got a question.
We
Goody.
Do. Let's go to this question.
We're figuring out where the button is to get John from Hurstbury.
John, are you there?
I am.
Well done.
Sorry, I was a little bit slow there, John. I suddenly went blank. I haven't done this for a while.
No, that's all right. It is frosty this morning.
I bet it is in Hurstbridge, yes.
It certainly is. I haven't seen it. I think it's probably the frostiest morning we've had this year. So yes. That's a good thing.
Oh, good. That might do my white fly some good.
Yes.
Look, I had a question. We've got some Philadelphus quite a bit, the mock orange, but we haven't been correct in pruning it, as in we haven't done that. And it's probably now about 8 foot tall, maybe even a bit more. Mm-hmm. And just wondering when and how much to bring it back down.
If it's an 8 foot Philadelphus, then it's an 8 foot Philadelphus, is the way I look at it. And what I would be doing is just thinning older stems out of the plant, because if you prune it down, I mean, Philadelphus come up and they arch over. If you prune them down, you end up with these truncated sticks, and it does not look good. So I go through my Philadelphuses every couple of years, and I cut the oldest canes out of the plant, so the really ones that have gone twiggy, and I leave the nice arching natural canes in place. And so if it's a tall growing one, I mean, I've got one in the garden at the nursery that I've had for donkey's years that is one called Natchez, which gets huge big flowers on it. Not a great scent, but it has big, big white flowers on it, easily 10 to 12 feet tall. Yeah. It's a really big shrub. And if I cut it back hard, I ruin the shape of it. It often doesn't flower terribly well the following year after it's been pruned back, because it goes into lots of water shoot growth. And so you just get into the habit of thinning out the older stems, and that way you're refurbishing the bush all the time. That's how I would deal with it.
So that's, does it matter that it's 8 foot tall in your spot, John?
We've got about 30 or 40 of them in the one area.
Oh, gosh, that's spectacular.
So, no, it does look really nice. Yeah.
30 or 40, that's a huge number, John.
It is. It's a big area.
Obviously. But,
So getting in at them to pick out one or two canes that are
older canes,
is probably a bit more of a challenge. I was thinking more of just going right over the top.
Look, if you're going to do that, take them down to ground level and start them off again, but you won't get many flowers the following year.
But if you've got that many, you could take half of them down.
You don't have to prune them all in the one year.
Yeah.
But
and they're pretty tough. I mean, if you ran over them with the chainsaw, I don't think they'd really mind.
No, but you won't get them to flower well the next year. They'll go into a whole lot of water shoot growth, which will almost replace the height again. So don't assume pruning is going to keep them down. They're still going to want to get to the height they want to get to. So, but it will refurbish them and it'll clean them up. It'll get rid of all the crappy stuff in them.
Do they flower on new wood?
They tend to flower in the wood they produced the previous year.
So they flower on one-year-old wood.
Yeah,
right.
So,
but that must be a scent sensation, John. The perfume must be wonderful.
No. Look, it's really nice. It's a lovely area. All right. And if I were to do either of those suggested actions, when would I do them?
Oh, straight after flowering.
Yep.
Okay.
It's the rule with most plants. I mean, if it's particularly if it's spring flowering, you do them straight after flowering. That gives them the longest possible time to refurbish before the next winter sets in, and then you've got far more chance of getting at least some flowers the following year if you've pruned really hard.
Yeah. Okay. At the moment, the base of them are fairly leafless, which is probably because they haven't been getting light and all that, but the top of them still got green leaves and such on.
Yep. I think I'd prune them irregularly and not all of them at once.
All right. Lovely. Thank you.
Good job, John, for planting that many. Good job.
Yeah, it was done a while ago. all right. Thank you very much, team.
Thanks for calling
in. Thanks, John.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
That was good.
Yeah.
What a fabulous panel and discussion. And welcome back to country, Stephen and Virginia. Other things to add to the list. Sonchus. Mm. I thought I'd killed mine the first summer. Ha ha.
Yeah, some of those woody sonchuses just go completely herbaceous. They go completely deciduous in the middle of summer. Mm. So if it gets hot and dry, some of the Canary Island ones, they just drop all their leaves. And come the cool weather, off they go again.
I think it's very clever.
David, I have got a sonchus that has sown itself into the most unusual place in my driveway, and I've just left it. And I had a visitor yesterday, and I don't know how many times she kept going past it saying, "This is wonderful, this plant."
They're great. I love the sonchus.
We saw some pretty good sonchus in
Madeira. The Madeira native one, Sonchus fruticosa, has the biggest leaf of any sonchus. It's not as drought tolerant, unfortunately, because it comes from a slightly damper place than the Canaries, because Madeira certainly is.
Sonchus come from the Canaries?
Virtually all of the woody, shrubby sonchuses come from the Canaries, yes.
I've got two. One has got a leaf a bit like the Madeiran one we saw, and the other one's got a very, very, very fine leaf.
Oh, yes. I know the one you mean, but I can't remember its name. But, yes, I've got at least two or three. I've got, funnily enough, Canariensis. I've got Palmensis that comes from La Palma Island. I've got the Fruticosa, which is the Madeiran one. I've got a feeling of – I've got the very fine leaf one as well in the front garden. So I've got a few of them around. And for anybody who doesn't know what a sonchus looks like, they're – heavy wooded shrubs that normally don't grow too big, 2 to 3 metres for most of the shrubby ones. They have very handsome foliage and they get clusters of bright yellow dandelion-like flowers on them. They look like a milk thistle that's got on steroids, basically. But they are great plants, the sonchus. And, yes, a lot of them, they don't go actually herbaceous in the summer, but they will go dormant in the summer.
Yes.
I'm sorry, if we've got a question, we should deal with that first. But no, I thought it might be time for us to offer our free offer. We're hoping that people who call in to take up the opportunity of having some seeds sent to them might actually go onto the 3CR website and make a donation as well. But we decided that we'd talk about plants from Madeira and the Azores today. And so as soon as the word Madeira came to me, it had to be geranium madurensis that I talked about.
Which we didn't see much of.
Well, it's quite rare in the wild.
It's only apparently, I looked up last night, they reckon there's only about 50 plants left in the wild. So it is critically endangered.
And it's Australian things that are the weeds.
Yes. We're responsible for lots of eucalypts in Portugal as well.
Yes.
And wattles.
Yes.
The black wattle.
Yeah, it's everywhere in Madeira.
But unfortunately, geranium madurensis isn't everywhere in Madeira.
And it's such a beautiful plant.
Oh,
it's the biggest one, isn't it?
Well, sometimes Palmatum outstrips it, but they sort of vie for being the biggest geranium of the whole Cranesbill family. But what a handsome plant. Thank God it is such a beautiful plant because it's been adopted by gardeners.
If you're going to be rare, it pays to be attractive.
It does. You get to live on in gardens.
Yes, exactly.
But I should describe it because if you haven't seen one, it is a sight to behold. It comes up how would you describe them? Sort of palm-like leaves, very attractive, glossy, green, big leaves. Mm. And they're born on long stems that are usually a lovely reddy colour, which sets off the dark green leaves extremely well. And then it starts to come up in its second year into flower. And this is when it is truly spectacular because a healthy plant can have up to 1,000 blossoms on it in a big clouded head.
It's like a bouquet.
It is.
It's huge bouquet of flowers.
It's a cloud of flowers. The typical single Cranesbill style flowers. Once it flowers, this head of flowers is so heavy, the clever plant has to find a way to prop itself up on the cliffs, and it usually does grow along the cliffs of Madeira in its native habitat. It needs to prop itself up because it grows in very windy sites. And so the leaf stems, as it flowers, start to bend down, and they actually jab into the ground to hold this.
They become props.
They do. And so it's propped itself.
So don't
all the
cut
way around
the dead leaves off.
No, no, it's just doing its thing yes. to hold up this magnificent head. And even in seed pod, it is a very beautiful plant because it has the long seed casings that give the cranesbill family their name because they really do look like cranesbills and they're rather big. It's a very clever plant to seed as well. It is monocarpic, so once it's had in its second year this massive head of flowers, it will go off to seed and that will be the end of that particular plant. But do not worry because it's a generous provider of seed. It's not invasive, but it will seed
just around that spot
itself. Mm. So you've always got the next generation coming on. So I never know which plant it is, which year's plant it is, because they're always just in their place in the garden. And so you have the babies coming, the first year plants and the second year plants flowering.
And you can get it in both white and...
Correct. The pink is the wild native one, but on the island of Guernsey, there once came a little mutant spore with white flowers with a pink eye. And so that's been stabilised as a seed line now, and it's known as Guernsey White. So our offer is we have, well, three packets of the pink form, the original Geranium madurense, which is so rare now in the wild, and three packets of the white Geranium madurense, Guernsey White. So if you would be kind enough to ring into 3CR, and Virginia will give you the numbers again, and leave your name and address with our wonderful producers in the back room there, they will give me your name and address and I will post your packets of seeds out to you. But it would be so nice if you went on.
Make a donation.
Make a donation and help us out. We've been going for 50 years and we're going for the next 50.
And you can find that on our website.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's actually very easy because it just has a donation button to go to.
Great.
And the phone number, if you wish to, for the 3CR Gardening Show, donate some money and receive some seeds, 94198377.
Good.
So that would be excellent.
Yeah, so we're sort of, I guess, reinstigating the supporter segment.
Well, we just thought after last week's program we should do it. And Meryl, this is Meryl's initiative completely, and she's bearing the cost of sending them out, which is really good.
Yeah, so be generous. Give us a nice little donation. You know that it all goes to keeping 3CR on air, which, of course, then means that you're keeping the garden show on air.
And so we love this garden show.
Yeah, yes. Well, it's the best.
It
of course
is.
We do.
Right, we have another question. When will beneficial wasps return? Caller from South Australia has seen plenty of cabbage whites and wonders where the predators are.
The weather has been against us. The old cabbage whites have lived on at my place too. I think they've finally gone now. The frosts have started, but even last week there were a few fluttering about.
Yes, probably laying their eggs in your broccoli.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh dear, I have no idea. So I think it's just one of those things we just have to live through to an
extent. The thing I found in my garden last week was not a beneficial wasp, but a very European wasp nest.
Oh, goodness me.
Which I'm not happy about.
No.
Horrible
and it's going
things.
To be really hard to get rid of because of where it is.
Yeah.
They've gone and found the perfect place, the creeps.
Well, of course they do. That's why they're a pest.
And Vicky and Peter have sent in... Last week we saw Canadian nigricans in garden in flower. However, it was Canadian nigrans minstrel, the form with black and white flowers.
Ooh, that'd be so nice.
It's been around since 1983 and the name minstrel was registered. Well, I had one in my place and unfortunately it's died on me.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. I've got the ordinary Canadian, which is where my weebills nest. And it's huge and dominant, but I had the black and yellow, not the black and white, but the black and yellow is also totally spectacular.
Oh, it's a fabulous plant.
Wonderful plant.
As long as you give it room, because it can get big.
Does the black and white one grow a little smaller than the traditional coloured one?
I don't know. Pete, we could do with another text. Does the black and white one grow smaller than the black and yellow one?
I'm plotting here. My colour scheme, the colour scheme's coming to me.
But also, will it live through your frost? Yes. Well, yes, it lives in Warburton,
yeah,
so it will.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, it should. Yeah, yes. It should.
It's a wonderful plant.
All right, so we're expecting a text back in due course.
Yes, thank you.
Will we move on to another plant?
Yes.
Now, I brought along two flowers and one leaf off mandrake, and I adore mandrake for lots of reasons. One is it's a great winter flowering plant, so you get this rosette of huge, big, sort of slightly raspy leaves. So the leaves are what, about a foot long in the old measurement. So your clump of mandrake will be 2 feet wide.
Yes.
And in a circle. So you get this rosette of leaves. And then down in the centre, you get this mound of these fabulous purpley blue flowers on it, which are just gorgeous. And of course, mandrake's one of those things that has a massive mythology and nonsense surrounding it.
Now, is it poisonous, Stephen?
It is poisonous. Yes, it is poisonous. But one does have to consume it first.
Yes.
So, you know, and really everything's edible, but some only once. And so, yes, mandrake is poisonous, but so are daffodils and so is Daphne, and there's so many poisonous plants around us. You've just got to be
what you sensible. Assume is if it's not a vegetable, it's poisonous.
Yeah, that's right. You don't eat things that you're not aware of. The mandrake is also like the other plants we're talking about, where it comes up in the winter. You've got this fabulous rosette of leaves. You've got the flowers at this time of the year. It's actually almost going over now.
Mm-hmm.
And then come spring, get a few warm days, it just retreats and disappears. So I've got mine growing around the edge of a dwarf Korean lilac. So it gets lots of light in the winter, but it's in dry, shadish sort of spot for the summer. And I've got two plants, well, I've actually got four plants in now because I planted two seedlings I raised as well. But two main big plants in it, in this area. And I'm finding that it won't set seed unless I hand pollinate it.
So there's no pollinators for it naturally.
Doesn't seem to be anything that comes in. And unfortunately, because I was away this year, I was really a bit late to try and pollinate it. So I haven't had a chance to do anything with it. I might hobble out into the garden in the next day or two and see if I can still find some pollen.
What's its proper name?
Mandragora officinalis.
So it is mandrake.
Mandrake.
And it was a medicinal plant.
Yeah, they used it for medicine.
You had to be very skilled in administering the dose.
Well, you either fixed it or killed it.
Yes.
which is the way it sort of worked. And, of course, it was so valuable in its time that the apothecaries of the time set up all this mythology around it. And it's purportedly you can't take mandrake out of the ground unless you tie it to a dog's tail and you plug your ears so that you won't hear the scream of the mandrake as it comes out of the ground. Otherwise, it will send you mad. So there's all this fabulous mythology around
which was basically to protect the apothecaries.
Yeah, they didn't want you collecting your So I love all of that stuff. And, of course, Harry Potter made mandrake famous again amongst young children because they were doing their herbology and had to repot mandrake with plugs in their ears because the little plants were screaming. So it's a fabulous plant. There are a number of species. They come mainly from Mediterranean through into the Caucasus. I would love to lay my hands on some other species of mandrake. I think they're all stunningly beautiful plants. But this is the only one I've managed to have so far. And
So if we know anybody who's got other mandrakes, do let us know.
Yeah, I'd
or
love
let
to,
Stephen know.
Yeah, let me know, certainly. And if anybody's interested in a mandrake, first in best dress, because I've got about 8 or 10 to sell up at the nursery in 15-centimetre pots. So second-year seedlings.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of poisonous plants, you know, people do get sometimes rather stressed about, you know, have I got poisonous plants in my garden?
The answer is yes.
Yes, you undoubtedly have because so many plants are actually poisonous. But number one, it depends on the dose. And I mean, I understand people are concerned about their toddlers. Will they go grazing around the garden? But the beauty of nature is often plants that are really poisonous have got a sort of self-protection device. They have burning sap like euphorbias. Yeah, you won't eat it for long. No, you won't get it down you because it'll just burn your lips straight away.
Yeah.
And lots of plants have that sort of natural protection, especially if they come from environments where there are native grazing animals like goats or sheep or, you know, deer. They have their own built-in protection. Yeah. So
it's unlikely to poison yourself unless you can swallow something without chewing it.
Exactly.
You're unlikely to poison yourself with a poisonous plant. So I think we get a little too over-worried about these things. And I have to say, as children get a little bit older, they need to be trained not to put things in their mouths that they shouldn't. I mean, that's all part of bringing people
how
up.
How often do we hear of a child who's poisoned themselves in the garden?
Well, there must be the odd one.
I can't think of a single one that I know.
I don't know of any
And
either.
I do have a child. I have got children around.
I've got grandchildren, exactly. Mm. But they don't tend to eat things that taste horrible or burn their lips and most plants don't have that protection.
We don't have chocolate in our garden.
No.
Well, at Easter I do. Yeah, so anyhow, so mandrago. So that's the second one I brought along. And the last one I brought along is the variegated form of acanthus.
Which I love.
Yeah.
I'm sometimes a bit suspicious about acanthus, yes, that they might be too invasive.
Yeah.
When they're bad, they're very bad.
When they're good, they're fabulous.
They're very, very good.
Yeah. And even acanthus mollis, if you plant it somewhere where nothing else will grow, in the dense shade of a root-infested part of a garden somewhere,
they will grow.
They will grow, and they're fabulous. And when they die down in the summer, they might leave a gap, but they look fabulous through the winter months. And if you can grow nothing else there, wouldn't it be better to have acanthus? And believe it or not, I hold the national collection of acanthus in my garden at Macedon for Plant Trust. So it's one of the four national collections I've got. And this one's getting around a little bit now, and it's being sold as whitewater. I originally got it, and I think it's the same plant, really, just as variegata.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see any difference between the original variegata I got and the white water that I've got in the garden at home. So I think somebody just got a bit clever and gave it a fancy name. Fair enough, in a way.
But it is a beautiful plant.
A fabulous plant, and it has nowhere near the vigour. In fact, if anything, it could be a little more vigorous.
I was about to say, I actually had to keep mine in a pot under the trees, in the nasty place, but in a pot so that I could give it a little bit more TL. Because it is, maybe it's the variegation, the white splashing all around the edge of the leaves. Very handsome plant with its. I'm a bit suspicious about variegations too, that they can look a bit like the plant is sick, but not in this case.
No, it looks fabulous and it stands out like a beacon in the shade.
In the shade, exactly.
And of course, because it's variegated, when the flower spikes come up, the flower spikes are all white. The flower spike goes all variegated. So you have white bracts.
And even a pinky tinge to it.
And it's
very pretty.
Beautiful, beautiful plant. So acanthus mollis whitewater or variegata. It is being grown by tissue culture, so there's a few growers that are buying the plugs and potting them on. So I've actually seen it in Bunnings. So it's not a rare plant, although it may be very seasonally rare.
Yes.
So you won't see it all the time. But I think it's a great thing.
I can throw another one into your collection, which I'm sure you already have, is Hollard's Gold.
Oh, I imported that years ago.
Exactly.
And
it is
fabulous.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful.
Another acanthus.
Yeah,
another
acanthus mollis, Hollard's Gold.
And again, the lack of chlorophyll slows it down.
Yeah, it's nowhere near as vigorous.
So it's not invasive.
And it's a soft greeny gold.
Yes.
Very goldish when the leaves first come up, but then they tend to go a light green.
And another shade plant.
And another good shade plant.
And a beauty because of that colouring. It glows in the dark.
Yeah, Hollard's Gold's fabulous.
Right, the calls are coming in.
Good.
Which is good. Our first one is asking about a plant in Rosanna, a tree. It's halfway down an embankment with other plants facing west. What can you tell us about this tree?
I think she wants to know what to plant, a suggestion.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Yes. I've got an embankment.
That's all right. We can hear you.
Halfway down in Rosanna, halfway down an embankment facing west. So it's actually shady. There is a dead tree on the site at the moment. I think it was a Chinese elm, but we can't tell because it's been dead for quite a while. We've just purchased this property. And there are lots of other plants in the embankment, so it's fairly shady. And I'm just wondering what to plant when we get rid of the dead tree.
Will it then get lots of light, or is it still going to be fairly shady?
It'll still be fairly shady. There's lots of kind of shrubby. There's a few, like, kumquat bushes there.
Mm-hmm.
Bits and pieces, really. Some of it I'm going to get rid of, but it'd still be fairly shady.
Okay. I would think you want to be thinking about getting some ground cover in first before you start pulling out your kumquats and things, because you don't want to destabilise it too much.
I'm not going to take out the kumquats. They can stay there. There is ground cover there.
Is it very dry or reasonable soil and fairly good moisture level? It would be well draining on an embankment.
Yeah. I think there's reasonable moisture there. I wondered about a silk floss tree.
I love that tree.
Yes.
Very beautiful. Pretty tree.
And not too big.
Yeah, so it's certainly a possibility, and it likes well-drained and will cope with a bit of dry if needs be. So you could look at something like that. So if you're looking for small trees, I'll just throw a couple of ideas into the mix.
That would be great.
You could look at things like some of the crab apples. They're tough trees and flower beautifully. Some of them have nice berries. Some of them have good autumn foliage. There's a whole range to select from, and none of the crab apples grow to vast trees, so they could be worthwhile considering. And another group of trees that I've been a bit of a champion for are some of the ornamental hawthorns.
Yes.
There's some gorgeous ornamental hawthorns out there, and if you wanted an evergreen one, the Mexican hawthorn is a fabulous tree.
And it's not as weedy as hawthorn, is it?
Well, none of the ornamental ones are particularly weedy. I mean, I've been growing some of them for 30 or 40 years and never had a seedling.
If they're double flower, the insects can't get in to pollinate them, so they don't actually throw any
seed.
Yeah,
any of the double-flowered ones don't actually have seed. So there's a couple of deciduous tree ideas, and I'll just throw a couple of names into the mix for smaller growing plants that you might want to use to cover the ground up a bit, because if it's an embankment, you don't want to be scrambling up and down at weeding all the time. So you need to get it full of stuff. And a couple of groups, or there's a couple of plants that I would definitely recommend, particularly for shade and definitely where it drains well. Things like ruscuses, so R-U-S-C-U-S. There's a whole group of different ruscus. And Virginia's putting her nose up, but they're bloody good plants and they're texturally really interesting.
I hate them.
And you can cut the foliage and it lasts in water for 6 weeks.
Yes, it would. It's awful.
Oh, for goodness sake. That's just Virginia's personal taste sneaking in here. There's some very
That's
good...
That's what gardening is.
Yes. And there's a relative of it called Danae. If you can lay your hands on Danae, it's a much more archy plant. And it will cover quite a big area and loves dry shade.
Ruscus would be fine for a bit of a ground cover?
Yeah, well, it grows up to about a metre and a half in most forms, but it clumps as it goes sideways.
Okay.
So you end if you planted three or four in a cluster, perhaps half a metre apart, that would cover that whole area.
And Lamandras would do a similar job, and because they're so tough, they've really been worked on with lots of different cultivars and colourways.
See, now my prejudice will sink in.
Yeah, he's going to turn up
Lamandras,
his nose.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are used to fill traffic islands.
They're so tough.
Yeah, I'm not a fan, I have to say. Some of the newer forms are a little more elegant than some of the older ones that were being grown.
No, I'm with you. I think Lamandras are awful.
Yes. Well, Virginia hates both of our suggestions, so that's going really well.
No, I love the silk floss tree.
Traffic islands filled with rubbish.
Exactly.
Yeah, so there's a few ideas for you, but obviously you'll need to get that dead tree down before you start any replanting.
There's quite a few grevilleas in there already.
Yeah. Well, they'll cover the ground quite well if they're the sort of
bushy
types.
Yeah, and they're growing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
So
And in natives, you could look at adding to the native side of it. You could put in some coriers. A lot of the coriers are quite shade tolerant.
I've put it in, on my bank, I've put in white Hardenbergia. And it is absolutely beautiful. And it's not growing up anything. It's just making a great big mound.
Yep.
And there's a Banksia, a little bit of it has grown up to up the Banksia next to it.
Yeah.
But it does look excellent.
So there's a few ideas for you.
Thank you. So just... all of those will do okay in shade.
Yeah, yes. that was what I took on board as the major important thing was the shade. So any of the things I've suggested would certainly be shade tolerant. And in fact, I fall back on things like Ruscus if I've got a spot absolutely nothing else will grow in.
Okay, great. And the crab apple's still okay in shade, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, as long as they've got room to grow because they're a tree.
Yeah.
So they need a little bit of space. But, yeah, they'll cope with a fair bit of shade depending on which crab apples you buy.
And you could also have a look at some of the viburnums because they're very good, tough plants.
Carlisii.
Yes, tough as old boots. Not too big. Sort of a tall shrub with pretensions to be a tree but not quite making it.
I call it delusions of grandeur.
Yes, that's right.
So viburnum carlisii, did you say?
Carlisii.
Carlisii.
Yeah, Carl.
C-A-R-L.
C-A-R-L.
E-double-S-I.
E-double-S-I. Okay, thank you so much for all of that.
It's good luck.
Thank you.
Sounds like an exciting project. Have fun.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. That sounds good. Now, our phone number is 94198377, and we have got two packets of pink geranium madurens left, and we are hoping that if you take one of these, if you would ring in if you want them and leave your address, and then we're hoping that you'll make a donation to the station. On the station's website.
Not compulsory, but would be so well received.
Would make us happy.
Yes. Exactly.
One of the things that I loved that I was surprised by in the Azores and Madeira was the blueberry.
Yes, the native ones.
Mm.
Yeah, they've got a couple of species that grow there, Vaccinium cylindrolaceum and Vaccinium... Palidiflora, I think the other one is. And they're moderately large, more or less deciduous shrubs. So they're like a normal blueberry in their form. They have quite long tubular flowers on them. So lovely sort of drooping tubular bell-like flowers. And certainly cylindrolaceum has a bit of variation in colour, but it can be quite a dark sort of salmon-y pink colour, the flowers, and they're great shrubs. And apparently the locals pick the berries and make blueberry jam and all that sort of thing in season.
As you would.
As far as I know, I've never seen either of the species from that part of the world available here, so I don't think they're in Australia, unfortunately.
They may have been used in breeding because blueberries are so popular. Mm. They've bred blueberries, Vacciniums, to go in all different climates, deciduous ones for people like us in cold winter climates and evergreen ones for people in warmer climates.
Well, I saw them when I was in Alaska in the wild.
Mm. Yeah.
And then I saw them in Madeira in the wild, and I can't think of two more different climates.
No, that's right.
They are pretty different. So I love getting back to Madeira and seeing them in flower because that's the time of the year we tend to go. And I see them as highly ornamental shrubs.
They're lovely.
A shame.
Yes, they
and, of course,
are.
We're unlikely to ever get them into Australia if they're not already here because they're related to a crop plant, as in we have our own blueberry industry here. They'd need to go through virus indexing and all sorts of things if you're going to try to bring them in. And that costs thousands. So nobody in their right mind is going to spend the sort of money that would be required to bring in a new blueberry species because it's just too hard.
There's a place in Warburton where they've got a blueberry crop.
Yeah.
But they're trees.
Mm.
It's it's absolutely, you look and you think, oh, apples? And it's blueberries.
And they grow very well in
five
pots.
Or six feet tall.
Yeah.
And they don't mind some shade. So they're a fruiting crop that you can have on balconies or shaded verandas if you haven't got much space or courtyard because they do really well in
pots. And they're pretty. I mean,
they're very pretty.
I don't have any objection to growing things you can eat, but I think they're always much, much better if they're also ornamental.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, things like blueberries, the ugni berries, there's lots of fruiting shrubs that are in fact also ornamental in their own right.
Yes.
And they're also tend to be very good for the birds because the birds like eating them as well as us.
Yes. I'd rather beat the birds to them, but anyhow, it is what it is.
Now, I have a question, I suppose, well, for both of you. Acanthus is a fabulous plant, but if you want to remove them...
Oh, good luck.
That's the issue.
Keep digging.
How does one get rid of those roots? Yeah.
Oh,
well, you can't get the roots out. You really can't. I mean, they go too deep, and any root you break is going to come up as a new plant. If you're determined to get rid of it, it's just a matter of persistence. You've just got to keep stopping it getting greenery.
That's exactly what I was going to suggest, Stephen, because I've got the problem on hand. We had a big clump of acanthus growing underneath the most beautiful yellow magnolia. And then we decided, no, we didn't want that anymore. We were going to turn it into a lawned area. Well, we did try digging it out.
Yes.
And that only encouraged it to shoot more. But what we've decided now, we haven't spread the soil or done anything about making the new lawn because we're just going to keep mowing it for as long as it takes.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the only way we're going to stop it.
Yeah. But even using nasty chemicals, it can be quite difficult to eradicate. So.
Well, the leaves won't accept the spray. They're so shiny and glossy.
So these two that you have both been talking about that are so lovely, the variegated yellow and the variegated
they're
white.
They're not invasive. Like,
I mean, if you tried to dig them out and put them somewhere else, you'll still have them come back up in the spot you dug them out of. So you need to be confident when you plant acanthus that you want to keep it there. Mm-hmm. But it's not going to spread out into great big colonies like the normal acanthus mollis does.
No.
And in fact, if anything, you might find the variegated one could easily slowly fade away on you.
I was going to say, you've got to nurture the white water.
Yeah.
It's not a strong grower, but well worth persevering with for both the foliage and those beautiful flowers.
And we have another one. My cottonous grace has grown too far over the path. Huh. When is the right time to cut it back and how hard can I go?
Go hard.
Yes, you can go very hard with the cottonous. So you can cut them right back to a stump.
But
they will send out water shoots again.
They will come back with... And Grace, I understand your problem.
Oh, Grace is hot. It's the only cottonous I don't like and I've got two of them and one of them is going.
Yeah, no, we had to remove ours completely for the same reason.
They're not attractive. They send out those huge long branches with nothing on them, no leaf on them.
One could almost say a bit of a lack of grace.
Yes. Perfect, Steve.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, some plants are not named appropriately, I think. But
well, I love cottonous.
Yeah. I do too. I've got as many as I can have, except for Grace. We did have to chop three of them out because they were bone ugly. Sorry for the people who bred Grace.
It's still a very popular cultivar around the trade.
I think that's because people don't realise what it's going to be.
How big
most
it's going
of them,
to get.
If you cut the cottonous, most of them, they make a really lovely shrub. You don't tend to get the flowers properly, but it makes a very nice shrub if you keep cupping it, but not the cotton, not Grace. And I think the only thing to do with Grace is to put her in the compost.
Sorry.
Oh, well, nothing like being opinionated.
But, you know, I was told, and I presume it's true, I was told that Grace was actually bred for the cut flower industry, and that's why it's
it could well
those
be
big,
yeah,
long,
those big wands.
Bare stems. Yeah.
Because that's the right word. Those wands are awful.
Yeah, but good for picking, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And if you do want to keep it, but reduce it down, well, just go hard. It will send up the new water shoots, which will be that strong arching growth.
And you
again.
Can do it with all of them in the botanic gardens. They've got quite a few cottonous and they do cut them every second year. They just cut them right down and keep them as shrubs, not as trees.
Well, that's a technique they use in England a lot for cottonous and a lot of those things that are grown for their foliage, because you get bigger, bolder leaves if you're coppicing them down on a semi-regular basis.
Throws them into that big arching growth.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there you go. Just a word of something that could work for people, though, if they've got something like that that is getting too big, a light summer prune. It's like pruning fruit trees in the summer. They tend not to shoot heavily after pruning in summer, whereas if you prune them in midwinter, then they start to shoot madly in the spring. So a summer prune might actually work with some of those things to keep them bushy. So
and
it's worth
also
a try.
Very important if you've got espaliered fruit trees. We've recently put in a row of espaliered fruit trees into a very narrow garden bed, and they're looking great. But yeah, the summer pruning is really important with them to keep them in check and keep them in shape.
Yes, because in actual fact, late winter, early spring pruning just encourages growth.
Yeah, it does.
Exactly.
Yeah, so the cottons might respond to it as well. I haven't tried it, but I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work. Mm.
But I do love the golden leaf cottonus. I think that is beautiful. Mm. It really, the sort of soft lime colouring of the leaves really does.
Actually, there's one called Canaria, which is in Australia. It showed up once. I got some plants of it, and then the grower doesn't seem to have had them again since. But when he was growing them, he couldn't spell or didn't like Canaria, so he called it Kermit. And it's a bright green-leafed one, and
like
the flower panicles are pure white.
Oh, wow.
And it's just beautiful, so it's well worth looking out for.
Just in case our listeners are not familiar with cottonus, common name is smokebush for the obvious reason. Their flower, they're like smoke. They really are the finest, fluffiest and huge flower bracts. They're wonderful.
And in high summer when they're really, really useful.
And
many of them colour well in the autumn as well, so their autumn foliage can be really good.
And they make good cut flowers.
And they're Mediterranean in origin, so they're summer drought hardy. I've never seen a cottonus killed by drought.
No.
I've seen one or two drowned, but I've never seen them killed by drought. So they are very useful plants in
our climate.
Highly
recommended for Australian gardens, yes.
Vicky and Peter have come back again. We have a variegated acanthus known as Tasmanian Angel.
Which I think is the same thing again.
I think it is the same.
Yeah, right. I think there's people throwing names out there all over the place.
Right. Also, our Ribes speciosa is flowering now, and of course it's summer dormant.
Yes.
Yes, very good suggestion. Mm. Well done,
folks.
Yes,
it's a good shrub, that. I love it. It's very prickly. But then anybody who's got a rose bush in their garden...
is used to prickles.
and they shouldn't say they won't grow anything else with prickles, because I regularly get that. People will come and say, oh, it's got prickles on it. And I say, have you got a rose bush? Yes. Well, then stop complaining and plant one. And, of course, anything that's prickly and twiggy, like the ribes is a great place for little birds to sneak into when they're trying to get protected from
things. I think it's really important to think about that when you're planting. You need to be planting for the little birds. I've got wee bill. And they love, I don't see them most of the year because they hang out so high.
Mm.
But of course, now that they're thinking about breeding, they come
looking for the shelter.
I see them all the time. And when the babies come out, honestly, wee bill babies, they behave like children. Mm. They all come out, and then for about a week they play, they chase each other, and they'll get tired from the chasing, and they'll stop on your head and then go on. You know, they're just that first week. I love weebills. They're so exciting.
Yeah. And they need good cover.
I had no small birds when I moved to my place.
Mm. Because they need that protection.
They need protection.
Actually, there is strong evidence that the balance of the bird species is changing dramatically in Australia because of habitat change. And it seems that the big birds are holding sway and the little birds are suffering.
It's particularly because of councils not being able to afford horticulturalists, and so they plant trees and shrubs and big shrubs.
Yeah,
and
open
they don't,
things.
Yeah, big, and they don't plant small shrubs and...
The dense prickly.
And the dense prickly
or sticky
ones.
A few weeks ago I saw my first rainbow lorikeet. We've never had them at Macedon.
Really?
Climate change.
The king parrots have moved in about 3 or 4 years ago, or maybe 5 or 6 years ago, but I saw my first rainbow lorikeet recently, and I've never seen them at Macedon. So they're obviously expanding their range.
Well, they've coped very well with us, for sure.
And, of course, that'll be just another thing to eat all my fruit.
Absolutely.
We adore our king parrots.
They're the most beautiful birds, but they are so sneaky.
They're very intelligent. Yeah. They are amongst the most intelligent.
What I find interesting is that the galahs are dominant over them. And so as soon as the galahs turn up, the kings get off the feeding tray.
Yeah, and the kings dominate the Mountain Lowries. They're dominated by the kings. But I shouldn't reveal the secret, but we
Please do. Nobody's here except
no,
us.
No, it's just nobody's us. Listening. It's only us three. But we have actually sighted a swift parrot. So
that is wonderful.
Yeah, no, there is a colony. There's a known colony not too far
from us, in Gippsland.
In Gippsland. How brilliant. Yeah, they're of course seasonal, but we did actually, it's the second time we've sighted one in our garden.
Done.
And oh, we were so excited.
I'm going next week to stay with friends in Tasmania, and they've got swift parrots nesting where they are.
Oh, that fabulous. Is.
And yes. The council think they're wonderful because of it. Because yeah. They have preserved the right,
the right habitat.
All about the plants. Habitat. Yeah, and some of my big salvias are just perfect for the small birds.
Yes,
they just love them, you know. And you don't have to plant ugly things, but you've got to think about small birds when you're planting. You're
getting some understory with plenty of coverage and lots of sticks.
Yes, exactly.
And hedges. I love hedges. Mm. I know David doing our hedges one year. We had to have a hedge with a sort of hiccup in the middle of it, a crenellation like a castle, because he was going along with the hedge trimmer and there was a nest of little baby blue wrens. So he went up, over and down again. Didn't take the heads off.
Well, speaking of unusual birds, when I was in Madeira, I saw a black-necked swan.
Ooh.
I've never seen one before. I was so excited.
I have to say that's one thing about Madeira and their zoos that's not normally terribly exciting is the fact that it doesn't have a huge
lot of bird.
Fauna.
Mm.
You know, there's a few native birds. They're only mammals. Native mammals are a couple of bat species.
It's the same as Hawaii. They're well out into the sea and only bats and seals.
Yeah.
Made it.
So it's the same with that part of the world. I mean, the Madeiran chaffinch is a cute little bird.
It's a gorgeous bird.
But there's not an awful lot of bird life on those
islands. Well, needless to say, this black-necked swan is not Madeiran.
Yeah.
No.
It comes from South America, but I have never seen one.
Mm. I did see them once and my eyes nearly fell out of my head.
Yes.
But they kept them as, decorative pets in palace gardens in Spain.
Ah. Oh, in Madeira they keep flamingos.
Don't they?
Yeah, the palace gardens there actually has a group of flamingos.
But they're very amazing, those flamingos.
Yeah.
They were extraordinary.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's where I saw the black-necked swan. Mm.
Actually, if you're talking about not unusual birds so much, but a bird that's out of its habitat, since the big fires up in New South Wales, which was several years ago now, we have had a wonga pigeon in our garden, which shouldn't be this far south by any stretch of the imagination. It came into the garden only within weeks of those fires, and it's been there ever since. And I feel so sorry for it because it hasn't got a mate. And it's become quite friendly. You can walk virtually up to it, and I've thrown seed down for it and it will come and pick up the seed and stuff. It's almost to the point where you could hand feed it, but it wanders around the garden going whoop, whoop, whoop.
looking for a friend.
Yeah, balefully looking for a mate, and it's not going to have one because we don't have any other wonga pigeons.
Mm. Sue from Red Hill wants some ground cover grevilleas to attract birds.
Mm.
Ah, lovely thought to plant ground cover grevilleas.
Yeah, well, I would go to Karanga Native Nursery and have a look at their range.
Mm. Yes.
If you're going to buy any sort of plant that's in a sort of area, so native or roses or whatever, then you go to somebody who's a specialist in that group of plants because you're going to get the widest range. You're also going to get the best information on the plants you want to get. You'll see the newest and the most up-to-date hybrids. And Karanga's worth going to just to go for a nice day outing and have something in the cafe. And
also walk around the back of it where they've got a garden.
Yeah, they've got a nice display garden there. Mm. And their stuff is all open grown, so it's not softened up or anything. Their prices are good and the range is probably as good as you'll get anywhere. And that's what I would do for a starter.
And the other thing I would say, Sue, is that Banksias are also, there's a couple of very good ground cover Banksias look fabulous.
Mm. Great foliage.
And the two together, which is what I've got on around my, I don't know whether it's a pond or a dam, it's too big for a dam, it's not actually
but it isn't actually a dam.
No.
But whatever it is around
your
that.
Your decorative water feature.
It's bigger than a water feature.
So I would, I mean, it's just logical to go to somebody who's an expert in a specific group.
Yep. And you were thinking?
I was thinking of Philip Johnson, who's just east of the Grampians. Oh,
Vaughan Johnson.
That's it.
Philip Vaughan.
We'll get there eventually, folks.
Pomonal, that's right.
In Pomonal. He has got the most... I don't know. Oh, he must be online, mustn't he? He won't be, but maybe his daughter is.
Yeah, and his plants are available, but he is just so knowledgeable, absolute expert, and a whiz at grafting native species onto the roots of other natives to make them adjustable to different conditions.
And Red Hill's a good place to grow.
Mm. Yes, exactly. But boy, has he got some beautiful stuff.
Yeah, that might be a weekend trip as opposed to a day trip, but yes.
But worth supporting too, because
he's got beautiful things.
He's had to face wildfires twice and has survived, and he just needs support and again, an Australian treasure.
Mm. And, of course, does he go to the Mount Macedon?
I don't know whether...
He always comes to the November...
Yarra Valley one.
He's always at the Yarra Valley Plant Fair. Yes,
so
with the
certainly you
range.
Could catch up with him there when that comes up. I'm assuming it will go ahead this
year.
Yes,
it is, absolutely. Yes, yep. I'm sending out the brochures. So good. It's definitely going ahead.
Good, glad to hear that. So there you go. So there's a few ideas. And I think, yes, always go to the expert if you can. I mean,
and
I'm not an expert on grevilleas, so I would
like
to... And
I've got a couple on that dam stroke pond. I've got a couple they're probably shoulder high, and that's because they've been there a long time. Mm. But they're the really common ones, Peaches and Cream and Superb. Mm-hmm. They are just at the moment, they're just coming into flower and they look so terrific, but that might be too big. You can get small, you know, lower ones.
There's some really nice low.
There's some wonderful low ones.
Low growing ones. The other thought, I mean, it's in the completely opposite direction, but the Melton Botanic Gardens has got a fabulous collection.
How could we not have thought of it?
And it would definitely be worthwhile to go out on a trip there. I'm hoping to be there next week if I'm up for it, to do some more filming. And the two genera we want to cover would be Banksia and Grevillea for our filming, because they've got probably 40 or 50 different species and cultivars of each.
And what a great thing to have flowering at this time of the year.
Absolutely.
And providing cover at this time of the year, because we've been talking about birds. And our birds are sometimes a little, our nectar-seeking birds are a little stressed at this time of the year. Thank God for salvias, which are feeding them beautifully in our garden. But those native ground covers blooming at this time of the year, also excellent nectar supply.
Yes, and Stephen, tell people where they can, in 2 weeks or 3 weeks after you've filmed in Melton, where can they pick this up?
Oh, yes, when we've done our filming, yes, those who don't already know, shame on you, you should already know.
we have new listeners.
Yeah, well, that's true. We do have new listeners. We have a friend of mine and I have our own YouTube channel called The Horti Culturalists. So it's Horti-Culturalists on YouTube. We post a gardening video every week. The one that's on that came up this Friday was on things that were flowering in my garden in the winter, so it's apropos of the season. And
you're doing one on Madeira.
Yes, that will probably be next week's. We're going to do a story on the endemic plants of Madeira and the Azores, because I did a bit of sneaky filming while we were over there and took lots of stills as well, so there was enough material there to put a story together. And following that, hopefully there'll be stories on some of the different genera of native plants in the Melton Botanic Garden. So we do something interesting every week. So we love it when people subscribe, press the alert button and watch the videos through, because all those things add to the algorithms of the YouTuber, which means it monetizes your YouTube channel. So it costs you nothing, but you can help us as well.
And you get great information.
Well, and that's what we're hoping to do, is to put out that information.
I was walking through Sissinghurst, which has always been one of my favourite gardens in Britain. I was a bit disappointed, I'll tell you, over coffee.
Yeah.
And somebody said to me, 3CR Gardening Show.
Don't you love it when that happens?
That's great.
It was excellent. Now we have another one from Pam. Ocean Grove Garden with established Magnolia grandiflora and Irish yew, Iachromas, Sasanquas, but need fast-growing tall trees to block potentially two double-storied houses, which I look down, which look down.
Overlook.
So we need some fast. And now, of course, as soon as you make a fast-growing tree, you make a tree that's probably not going to live as long as you might.
Yeah, fast-growing can often be short-lived. And it depends on when you say large-growing, just how large you need them to be. Because
an iachroma left alone can get pretty large.
Yeah, you know, so some things that only grow 3 or 4 metres can sometimes be tall enough to screen you out from something, particularly if it's uphill from you. So you don't always need to have big, big. I mean, there's oodles of things that you could grow. A plant I'll just throw in the mix if you can source it, because it doesn't grow too wide. So if it was planted as a screen along a fence, it wouldn't take up so much room within your garden and it wouldn't annoy the now builder of the two-storey house up behind you too much, is Azara microphylla from Chile. Grows up to about 5 metres.
And it's evergreen.
It's evergreen. Yep. It's fairly quick growing.
And
it's
fine leafed.
Fine leafed. It's dense enough to break up the outline of the house and give you screening, but not so dense as to be a complete block, which sometimes is better.
Yes.
You need the light and the wind through.
And the air to come through.
And it flowers in August. The flowers are inconspicuous, you won't see them, but it has the most fabulous vanilla fragrance that wafts all over the garden. And with a little bit of ground preparation, if you get them in 6 or 8 inch pots, within 18 months, 2 years, you could easily have them up to fence height.
Yep.
And it won't be that much longer before they get up to something mature in size.
Can we say the name again, please?
Azara, A-Z-A-R-A, microphylla, meaning small leafed, so M-I-C-R-O-P-H-Y-L-L-A. So Azara microphylla. It's a great little tree. It should be grown a lot more. It should, in fact, be one of those things that's regularly available in general garden centres. But for whatever reason, it's not become as common as it should. I've sold it to people all over the place and I've rarely had anybody have a problem with it.
Yeah. No, I've had one quite long-lived, so I don't think it's going to peter out too quickly.
No, I don't think it does, and I don't know that it's going to be an anciently living tree, but then nor are we anciently living people. So it would probably see the average homeowner out.
So have you got any other suggestions?
No, I went blank.
I nearly did. It can be difficult to make suggestions.
I was trying to think of something that was tall and narrow that would be quick growing. Lots of things that are tall and narrow, but not necessarily that faster growing.
Yeah. And I do wonder too whether even something deciduous wouldn't work.
Because just the line of it is enough to break.
If it's dense enough and the bare branches are there in the winter, they're often enough to break up a view. And, of course, dare I say, most of us aren't nude sunbathing in our back gardens in the middle of winter. So do you need quite as much and a little bit more light in the winter? So you could look at some of the upright growing crabapples, maybe.
I think crabapples are so underutilized. They're a fantastic tree. Yeah. They cope with – and, you know, the other – oh, I suppose it's not big enough. Actually, the Judas tree.
Yeah, they're not as big growing as you'd like, I don't think, sometimes for that sort of work, but they're great trees.
A wonderful tree.
I was thinking
of that for the embankment person.
Yeah.
And I love for screening, although probably not tall enough, are some of the narrow growing Sasanqua camellias. I love the foliage. I love the winter blossoms. The colours are superb and they make great screens, particularly if you're trying to stop dust. But there are some cultivars and varieties that are quite upright and narrow column
growing.
That's
true. There is some very...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they may just not get big enough. That's the only issue.
That's my only worry. Mm. You're not tall enough for this job.
Well, I hope... she says, thank you. Also, the magnolia is poorly. Yeah. And Lyle has had Azara.
Ah, good.
Good.
Yeah.
The magnolia is very big. I'm not sure that if it's poorly, I wouldn't just sacrifice it and go for something else.
Mm. Well, if it's a biggish old tree, I'd probably get an authority
to come look at it.
I mean, it may require some aid to help it along, it might need to have the ground uncompacted. So they might have to bring in one of those water things and and get some air down into the ground. They might need to give it a good dose of one of the seaweed products and all that sort of thing.
And also,
they can live a long, long time.
They
do.
Yes, they do.
And also, if our summer grasses are very, very powerful grasses, and sometimes they grow up underneath trees and the trees just need a break.
And the magnolias do have a fairly surface.
Yeah, very fibrous
surface.
So
if you've
got
to, you know, it's worth getting the grass out and then putting down mulch, I think, under a tree. It's made a huge difference to some of mine.
Driving some holes down and really pouring the water into the root.
There is a story behind that. I remember this terrible, terrible storm in the mid-'80s in Britain. Because I, at that stage, was living in my bedroom was in the roof, and I was just lying there all night thinking, I'm going to lose this roof. This is terrible. It's the worst storm I've ever lived through, I think.
Yeah, I was there for that storm too. It was
a shocker.
Corker.
And Kew lost a huge...
Oh, yeah, they had masses of trees.
Huge number of trees. And they had a big old oak that they'd been thinking, well, we're going to have to get rid of this. And it went over, but it didn't. It just went over, but not all of its roots were out of the ground. So they just propped it a bit and just left it because they were thinking of getting rid of it. So they did every other tree in the garden first. So some months later, they came back. I think it's called a Turner oak, to this oak that was looking shite, basically. Mm. And it had come good. And they were absolutely astounded. So they got all their tree specialist people in and they all scratched their heads and hummed and hard, and they decided that what had happened, it had been there for a couple of hundred years, back to when it had been a palace, etc., and they think it was just completely compacted and there was no air.
Yeah.
So they I saw it 3 weeks ago. It's still there.
Yeah.
Because and now they go round and they do that.
Deliberately
air in. And that's where that habit started.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we've just lost Robin Hood's oak tree.
Yes, the Sherwood oak has died,
because
sadly.
Because people walked around it too much and compacted.
Yes.
Anyway, I think we've got something happening on our screen there, which is lovely if we've got some more questions. Thank you for all the people who phoned in for the geranium madurensis seeds and making donations.
Yes, excellent.
Thank you.
Very, very good indeed.
No, well, I think we've only got a couple of minutes left, so let's have a little think about if there are any other summer deciduous plants that we really think people should be looking for. And on my canariensis, my Canarina canariensis, is it easy or can it be found?
Look, it's about a little bit. I've certainly got a few at the nursery at the moment.
Because it's a wonderful plant. Oh,
it's a gorgeous plant. I've got some up in the shade house at the nursery at the moment, so if anybody wants to come and get one, they can come up and get one of those when they come up to get their mandrake. And so I have a few up at the nursery. I don't know whether the Lyle's still growing it, but he did have it for a while. I wouldn't say it's one of those plants that's out and about. You'd have to do a bit of hunting for it, but it's definitely worth the effort. And apart from anything else, I haven't tried this yet because I've not had it set any seed pods, but apparently the fruit is edible as well. I keep reading about the edible fruit on that plant, and I've never had an opportunity to have a crack at it.
I've got heaps of seed pods on mine this year.
Have you? Oh, well, collect some of the seed for me.
We'll have a little nibble.
And have a crack at it.
Have you got it growing?
Yeah, no, I haven't at the moment. I did have one.
Well, you'll have to get some of my
sadly,
seed pods.
It got all split open in a big storm, and we had to take it out. But beautiful plant.
All right. So, so the Canarina canariensis is a great one, but there's oodles of other things that are looking
good.
One
thing we haven't mentioned is the Veltimia.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, I think that's a
spectacular
wonderful plant.
I don't do well with them. We're a bit cold up our way.
Are you?
Yeah, so I've
tried
a couple
you
of
do.
Yeah, no, but they're very sheltered.
Yeah.
Very
but,
sheltered.
You know, I've got spots where they should be all right, but they've never flourished for me in the garden at home, I'm afraid. So it's a bit sad. But
well, they're a wonderful plant. They're a South African bulb. Veltimia is V-E-L-T-H.
It looks like a pink-flowered aloe.
Yeah.
Almost. Yeah, but it's a bulb.
And they're not very big.
No.
And you know, the foliage is at ground level and the flower comes up to mid shin.
Mm.
But they're
and
wonderful
clear.
Because they're out now.
Actually, yeah. I just thought of another thing that's a weird thing, but I love it, that grows in my garden at home and just self-seeds itself. There's something that grows in the Mediterranean region, often in the sides of dry stone walls, and it's a thing called Umbilicus rupestris. And it has a round leaf.
We saw that in...
Yeah, we did see it when we were in Madeira or the Azores somewhere. It gets these round leaves with the leaf stem sitting underneath, just like a nasturtium does. Grows into a little mound of leaves. And then it sends up a flower spike with these little tiny green flowers running up it. It seeds, dies, and then the next generation starts coming up. And it germinates in the autumn when the rains come in. It grows through the winter, flowers in the spring, disappears again. Yeah. And it's the cutest little thing. And if it comes up where I don't want it, you can just so easily just pluck it out. It's got almost no roots underneath it. And yet, in somewhere like a dry stone wall where you'd never get anything in purposefully.
It puts itself
in there.
It's a great plant.
I think it's a lovely little thing. I mean, it's sort of pointless me trying to grow it for sale because it's so ephemeral. Yeah, it's so ephemeral that, you know, if you're selling a live plant in a pot, you've just got to tell people it's about to die. So, I love it in the garden at home.
We've had another message from Rosie. Absolutely loved this program and helped by England winning.
Good so on England you, Rosie.
Won. All right, thank
but
you for that,
be
Rosie.
Unbearable. They will be just beside themselves.
And she says about us, such chemistry between you.
So thank you very much to all listeners. Have we got time for one more plant or are we?
No, I think we're at our end. So this has been the 3CR Gardening Program. With you is me, Virginia Hayward, Merrill Johnson from Seedscape, and Stephen Ryan from Dicksonia. We've had a lovely
ball.
Time.
It's been a really good morning.
It's been fun.
Without the soccer.
Well, we've still had the reports in.
Well, it's important, yes, but I think it's a very interesting thing that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be thinking about things that are summer dormant because our summers are likely to be getting worse.
Yes. Mm.
Exactly. So we need to think of our gardens in the reverse form that we've always thought of. You think of winter as the downtime, summer as the uptime.
Oh, no, winter is the lovely time.
Yeah, and I think if we look at it in a different way and we let the garden go a bit to sleep in summer, why not indeed? It's less work.
Yes,
absolutely. And, of course, the other thing is that in summer we don't really go out terribly much in the garden. And I can never understand why the open garden scheme is closed during winter. Mm. I just think that's really, really silly.
It's sad.
But anyway, that's us for today. Hope you enjoyed the show and we'll see you soon.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.